This is On Target St. John's, a look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
And good afternoon, everyone. Well, it will come as no surprise to most Newfoundlanders and Labradorians. These are things that we've been wringing our hands and grinding our teeth over for, it seems like, since we entered Confederation. The province is facing a serious economic situation that needs to be addressed. If you recall, back in May, the PERT report was released, and it's still generating great reaction and response. The 300-page document, as you may recall, was called The Big Reset, and it laid out some pretty harsh realities of the situation the province currently finds itself in and some of the steps that should be taken to help right the ship, as the Premier Fury likes to say. Team Chair Moya Green said at the time that it is possible to do so, but only through a combination of tax increases and spending cuts that would lead to a balanced budget within 6 years. Specifically, the report recommends reducing operating grants for MUN and the College of the North Atlantic by 30% over the next 6 years. And we've already seen some movement in that realm with in terms of tuition and the like, as well as the regional health authorities. It says grants to other government agencies should be cut by 20%. The PERT report also recommended the elimination of Nalcor Energy, and it wasn't long before the provincial government announced that Nalcor was being folded into Newfoundland and Labrador Hydro. And of course, the president and CEO there is also president and CEO now of Nalcor Energy. The report also recommended new taxes on some of the richest people in the province, as well as a 5% reduction in core spending across the board. And a lot of this came out before the most recent budget. And you could start to see some movement in those directions. Although, if you recall, PERT was delayed somewhat and the budget is subsequently delayed. But, you know, a lot of the actions that were recommended in the PERT report couldn't be implemented in the current budget year. But you could see some of those signals being sent at the time. Among the past decisions made leading to the province's current fiscal situation, many argue, was the decision to sanction and develop Muskrat Falls. Well, there's an economic conference in St. John's today, hosted by MUN's Department of Economics, and it's been exploring some of these ideas and getting some thoughts and feelings on the province's fiscal situation, how to address it, and the like. And among the speakers today was none other than former Premier Danny Williams. And he's the man that some people have blamed for the economic millstone that is Muskrat Falls. Well, he lays out once again his thoughts and feelings on the matter of what led to the decision to develop Muskrat Falls. And we're going to play you some of that speech because, if I'm not mistaken, he's still speaking. So we've been able to grab some of this, the sections of this speech to allow you to hear it and make up your own mind whether or not, in retrospect, this was a good idea or not. So when we come back after the break, we'll play you some of that right after this.
Join Brian Medore weekdays at noon for a comprehensive update on news from every corner on all levels. Newsmakers, weather, and more. Join us on your VOCM at noon.
And we're back. And you may recall yesterday on Target, we aired an interview, an extended interview that VOCM's Jerry Lynn Mackey did with a Canadian philanthropist and founder of the Dominion Bond Rating Agency, Walter Schroeder, who gave his thoughts on Muskrat Falls and what to do with that. He paid a visit to St. John's recently, of course, for the official launch of a new theater and entertainment production company. And he says the province is facing a dire fiscal situation exacerbated by Muskrat Falls and what Schroeder calls a lopsided equalization process. And he suggested that the federal government buy Muskrat Falls from the province for $5 billion that we've already invested into it, meaning that Ottawa will take over the $8 billion in debt it has guaranteed, keep the project until 2041 when the upper Churchill contract comes to an end, and then sell it back to the province at that time. And he figured that that was a better way to go about it than some of the rate mitigation plans that are currently underway. Well, arguably one of the architects of Muskrat Falls spoke today for the first time in quite some time. He addressed an economic conference in St. John's today, and we thought you might like to hear some of what Danny Williams had to say. Here's part of his speech.
I'd like to begin, I guess, first by thanking Memorial's Dr. Timmons and the CARE Initiative and the Atlantic Institute of Policy Research for bringing us together to discuss the economic trajectory of Newfoundland and Labrador. I was encouraged by the introductory words of the conference materials that stated, and I quote, "Compromise and a common objective, devoid of political stripes and specific interest groups, will be needed, as this is precisely what our province needs as we navigate the difficult road ahead." So I'm not here to speak from a partisan perspective, not to pass judgment on current or past leaders and governments, but merely to speak from my own experience and unique viewpoint as a former premier of our great province. I feel it is important to be reminded of how our policies actually made positive and identifiable differences in the lives of our residents, and to remind you about how we felt as a people during our time, proudly holding our heads high in this federation and giving our young people hope for a better tomorrow. I feel that some of that has been lost in the intervening years, and as we emerge from the global pandemic, I would love to see a renewal of that positive energy. Disraeli once said, quote, "The English nation is never so great as in adversity." And I think Newfoundland and Labrador is no different. I entered the Premier's office in 2003, having spent nearly 3 years as leader of the opposition. I've said before that during that time, I estimate I read approximately 500,000 pages of materials, commissions, reports, and best practices from around the globe. I sought counsel from some of the most experienced, diverse, and knowledgeable people that I could find. I read, I listened, and I learned. And when we formed government, we had a thoughtful, strategic, and a well-researched plan for economic, social, and cultural prosperity. You will recall a PricewaterhouseCoopers report early in our mandate confirmed our worst fears. Without substantial measures to deal with our fiscal realities, we were facing bankruptcy as a province. And while the slash and cut approach sounds simple, anyone who has ever held office knows that approach is neither politically nor economically practical. Efficiencies had to be found, but not at any cost. Nonetheless, that report did result in cancellations, deferrals, and expenditure constraint, which immediately led to a public sector strike. 3 months after our election, tens of thousands of workers were chanting angrily on the steps and lawns of the Confederation Building. And yes, as an aside, they were delivering horse manure to my parking lot in the Confederation Building. But generally, people understood. One of those very workers 2 years later said to me, quote, "I hated you then, but I understand now why you had to do it." Despite our limited resources, we began in earnest implementing our long-term plans to rebuild. And Band-Aid solutions were not the answer. We chose, indeed, to primarily focus on identifying major potential sources of new revenue. Our approach was primarily fourfold. First, going after more equitable partnerships with the federal government, including the Atlantic Accord. Second, revisiting arrangements with our oil and gas partners for more lucrative returns to our province. Third, reassessing the Grand Churchill River and hydroelectric development. The fourth and more intangible piece was cultivating a renewed sense of self and place for the people of the province within the Canadian Federation. As it turns out, It was an invaluable piece of the puzzle. But it all had to start with the big bucks. A simple pie chart revealed that our share of the Atlantic Accord revenues was approximately a meager 15%. This very basic yet powerful piece of information was enough to convince Prime Minister Paul Martin that we are in fact not the principal beneficiaries of our oil and gas revenues, as was intended by the Accord. And he agreed to revisit it. It took 7 months and the help of many allies to overcome the federal finance bureaucracy, but we succeeded. And the symbolism when we brought home that check for $2 billion was a TSN turning point for both the psyche and the coffers of our province. Now, fair warning, conference organizers have asked me to talk about why our government did what we did. So buckle up for a little trip down memory lane. I've been given about a half an hour, including what I've already used up. With the Accord money in hand, the deficit came down and we commenced implementation of our strategic plan. It started with the basics, addressing the crumbling infrastructure province-wide. We increased essential infrastructure spending annually to eventually more than $1 billion in 2010. Not only did it create massive employment, but this spending on roads, the Trans-Labrador Highway, broadband, schools, hospitals, long-term care facilities, and so on, sent a clear signal to business that they could invest in our rural communities. It gave them confidence knowing that the nuts and bolts infrastructure necessary for success would be there for them. But we didn't focus only on bricks and mortar. We implemented tax relief, including a large personal income tax reduction, and eliminating it altogether for low-income earners. And we increased minimum wages, putting more income in the hands of those who needed it most. Our healthcare budget increased to $2.7 billion. For badly needed services and facilities, from insulin pumps for children to the province's first PET scanner. We spent where we felt it was needed. With an investment of approximately $500 million, we developed and implemented an innovative poverty reduction strategy that was heralded by national experts as a model for Canada. There were significant increases in education funding, including here at MUN and the College of the North Atlantic, including both a new academic building and student residences in St. John's. Our K-12 budget hit over $1 billion, including capping class sizes, and we delivered the best student aid package in the country. Coupled with our youth retention and attraction program, our goal was to see our young people not just survive, but to thrive here. We invested millions in an innovation strategy, creating a $20 million commercialization fund and regional sectoral diversification fund. We revived the aquaculture industry to help communities on the Niagara Peninsula, where they were experiencing almost 100% unemployment in many communities. And we stepped up for workers when multinational companies like Abitibi just walked away. We developed a thorough immigration strategy, and our ocean strategy was designed to put that industry at the forefront of the province where it is today. And in order to stimulate information technology, we appointed a chief information officer to direct growth of that industry and more evenly distribute the business. We also launched the province's first strategic cultural plan. We were proud to be among the first investors in both the Republic of Doyle and the Fogo Island Inn. I sat with the Alan Hawkos and the Zeta Cobbs of the world and was inspired by their vision and knew these type of investments would pay massive dividends. I'm glad to see governments since continue to invest in this kind of activity as it puts our province on the map in ways that oil, gas, and hydropower never will. We also revitalized our tourism marketing. I recall at the time, our entire marketing budget for the province, and that was because it was within our means, was equivalent only to that of a local brewery's marketing budget. We refocused and delivered Newfoundland and Labrador into a whole new era as a preferred tourist destination with internationally award-winning ads. We rebranded ourselves as Canada's youngest and coolest province. And we were just hitting our stride when the global recession hit in 2008. But we did not take our foot off the gas, as we knew that this would stop our momentum dead in its tracks. We continued to fuel the economy and emerge from the recession with increases in GDP, retail sales, employment investment, and even a population spurt. We continued with infrastructure funding and also supported business attraction, the fishery, farming, forestry, and mining through incentives. We provided significant funding to our Northern Strategic Plan for Labrador and negotiated the landmark New Dawn Agreement with the Innu based upon fairness and equity. Of note, this also included redress for the Upper Churchill, which we felt determined to include, knowing how unjust it is that Quebec refuses to do likewise for us as a province. While we continued to strategically invest, we also got our deficits under control and reduced our debt to $7.9 billion. And we became a HAB province for the first time in Confederation. It was a record I was proud to have office, to leave office with, and I remain very proud of it today. And of course, while all this was proceeding, we were simultaneously moving along with progress on the other two mega sources of potential revenue, oil and gas and the Churchill River. Our negotiations back then were based on three basic principles. No more giveaways, two, maximum benefits from our resources, and three, having a real and meaningful role in the development of our resources through ownership. The goals we achieved will result in tens of billions of dollars to our province from oil fields alone. We told one of the biggest corporations on the planet that the Hebron oil could stay in the ground, and despite backlash from industry and mostly mainland press, but the promise of clean, easily transported North American oil and pure stubbornness on the part of our government prevailed. We ultimately signed a favorable Hebron deal with higher royalties and equity stakes, resulting in significant revenues for the people of the province, the benefits of which we are still reaping today. Tough negotiating by Nalcor officials further resulted in significantly greater benefits, royalties and equity in other projects. More than 50% royalties and 10% equity, which is merely another word for increased profit share. Of note, these very profits are precisely the assets we can use today to assist with our current economic challenges. It's no wonder that rumors abound today that mainland banks and private interests are sniffing around to snap up the oil and gas division of Nalcor. It speaks to exactly how lucrative this provincially owned asset has become. And despite the negativity perpetuated around Nalcor, that company's assets, since we created it, have gone from approximately $2.5 billion to $19 billion. Now that, ladies and gentlemen, is real value.
That was former Premier Danny Williams speaking today at an economic conference here in St. John's. We're going to hear a little bit more from him right after the break.
Weekday mornings from 5:30 to 9. Jumpstart your day with Jerry Lynn Mackey and Ben Murphy. Newsmakers, traffic, weather, and more during your VOCM morning show.
And we're back on VOCM on Target. Well, we've been listening to part of a speech from a former Premier Danny Williams, who is long, but, you know, many people have been pointing the finger at him specifically for some of the problems that we're facing here in Newfoundland and Labrador today, in part due to the Muskrat Falls project. And we've been listening to some of a speech that he just delivered, as a matter of fact, in here in St. John's at an economic conference. We're going to tune into a little bit more of it now as we get more into the crux of his reasoning behind Muskrat Falls. Here you go.
There's no doubt that climate change must be addressed. And yes, an oil-producing province like ours must play a role. But the fact remains is that oil still plays a major part in the global and local economic reality. Is it not more reasonable and responsible to extract these resources from jurisdictions such as ours, where the processes are much more safe and environmentally sound than most other places in the world? Progressive and aggressive climate change policies can and should go hand in hand with thoughtful and sensible plans to manage our way through the transition from a non-renewable to a renewable future, with the ultimate target of a green economy squarely in our crosshairs. The energy plan that we developed in 2007 started that process. It was a comprehensive, long-term strategy that evolved from consultation and input from numerous shareholders. It was not just about hydro and oil and gas, but all of the valuable energy assets of the province collectively. As well as plans for energy efficiency, conservation, and climate change solution. It was a holistic approach to support responsible policy. A fact which is conveniently ignored by critics. Oscar Wilde said it best, "Cynics know the price of everything, but the value of nothing." The easiest thing in the world is to sit back behind a keyboard and start a blog or Twitter account and start criticizing. As noble as intentions may sometimes be, these individuals have little to no experience in what it means to actually do the work, face the tough challenges, and make those gut-wrenching decisions. I challenge them, put your name on a ballot and try making the tough calls. To govern effectively, and Premier Grimes is in the room and he would know as well as anybody, is to strike the delicate balance between making people happy and doing the right thing. It is taking into account with every decision the needs and the wants of the people you represent, the opposition, your caucus, the media, labor unions, business interests, all the while also working within the Canadian Federation, replete with diverging interests. Now, don't misunderstand me. Elected leaders should be held accountable and decisions placed under a microscope. But relentless criticism, lacking balance or context, should not rule the day. There are some pundits who've established a career for themselves with their slot on the evening news, criticizing me and others. And don't stare at me on the echo chamber of social media. I, for one, prefer healthy, lively, nonpartisan debate with constructive and meaningful solutions, precisely like this forum, what we're doing here today. And of course, that leads me into Muskrat Falls, which has become perhaps one of the most polarizing issues in our province since the Upper Churchill. If you don't mind, I'll have a drop of water before I start on that topic. There are some pundits who've established, even when I was diametrically opposed to another government's policy or plan, I would not actively wish for its failure without a thought for the good of the province. With Voisey's Bay, which Premier Grimes will recall well, I criticized and was quite vocal about the deal. But I also made genuine efforts to put forward alternate ideas to help improve the agreement. And I applaud his government of the day for undertaking that project, which has been and continues to be so beneficial for our province. So there are some legitimate criticisms out there in Muskrat Falls, made easier, of course, with the benefit of hindsight, and easier again when made from the outside looking in. Over time, those who fundamentally opposed Muskrat Falls from day one had taken advantage of the narrative to completely erase from public disclosure the very real and tangible benefits of that project. One small example, of course, being the space we're in today that Munn enjoys as a result of the generosity of our partners at Emera. That came out of that project. CEO Stan Marshall, unfortunately, chose hyperbole in calling Muskrat Falls a boondoggle. It is a word that not only belittles our province internationally, it does a disservice to the project, and most importantly, to the thousands of Newfoundlanders and Labradorians who work their butts off and continue to this day to bring this project online. The truth is, our government undertook Muskrat after years of intense review and analysis. It moved forward with the support of international experts, the federal government, consultants, and banks who were anxious to be our partners. In the intervening years since I've departed government, a lot of water has gone under the bridge. Cost overruns, delays, protests, global oil price fluctuations. But I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I can give you a list a mile long of projects from around the world that doubled their budgets and then some. Yet were ultimately hugely successful. Hibernia, initially labeled as a sinkhole. Valley Inco, which I've made reference to, huge success. Hydro projects in BC and Manitoba, and on and on. Our own Hebron was executed and managed by the most successful companies in the world and went from a $6 billion budget to $14 billion without even a murmur. Excluding interest, the capital costs of Muskrat have gone from $6 billion to $10 billion today, approximately, including modifications and new capital expenditures. There has been 11 years, five premiers, and two Nalcor CEOs in the intervening years. And Mr. Stan Marshall's personal commitment when he came on as CEO was to keep the project on time and on budget. That never happened. As his final Nalcor AGM, 5 years after taking over the project, he stated that when he arrived, $8 billion had been spent with nothing to show for it. A hole in the ground, is what he said. It was such an illogical and silly statement, and demonstrably untrue. Yet, just after that very same meeting, he implored the government to keep the valuable expertise that exists at Nalcor for the benefit of the province. The same people who, in his own words, built a hole in the ground for $8 billion. This is the type of rhetoric that angers me and is such a disservice to the people, the province, and the project. Now, our staunchest critics still complain that my approach has always been anything but Quebec. Simply not true. Believe me, we tried. I was willing to work with anyone who would agree to a fair deal. But historically, Hydro-Quebec has not only not given us fair deals, they have taken advantage of or obstructed us every step of the way. They have not redressed the Upper Churchill. They challenge us at court in every turn. They have consistently refused us access to transmit electricity across their territory, despite North American FERC regulations, which say they must.
You've been listening to part of a speech performed by Danny Williams at a recent economic conference that's actually taking place in St. John's today. And this was just a few moments ago. We've been playing some of it for you for a little bit of, some of Danny Williams' take on Muskrat Falls, a project that a lot of people in Newfoundland and Labrador feel is partly responsible for the economic situation we're in today. We'll have a little bit more coming up right after this.
Every Saturday is perfect for a night at the cabin. The Cabin Party with Brian O'Connell. Saturday night starting at 7 p.m. on VOCM.
And we're back on Target. And we've been listening to Danny Williams and his explanation of the decisions that went into Muskrat Falls and what he still sees as a good project, and Nalcor being a good decision as well. But he didn't get an easy ride. This is at a economic news conference that was held today and is being held today here in St. John's. And they opened the floor up to questions from the floor. And here's some of, some of the opinion of on the floor presented to former Premier Danny Williams and what he had to say to that.
In your speech, Mr. Williams, you inferred that those who oppose Muskrat Falls and some of your decision-making hide behind blogs and Twitter accounts and don't have the gall to step up to run for office. It is very difficult to speak truth to power. So I am not going to hide behind my tweet today. And of course, as you may know, I am now currently in my third run for office. So I will stand here and I will say that I found it distasteful how you treated proponents who oppose and are calling out the grave. And I found it very disappointing in your speech. You did not at all acknowledge the impacts of the debt to this province directly because of decisions that you led regarding Muskrat Falls are impacting every man, woman, and child right now. I found it distasteful, and I wanted to come to the microphone to tell you to your face so I won't be accused of hiding behind a tweet. Thank you.
Well, I must say I sincerely apologize to you if you if you found it distasteful. That certainly wasn't my intention. I think part of the frustration that I experienced, I did indicate that running for office is difficult. And I looked down there before for Premier Vines, but I now see my straight in front of me, is that it's a difficult mix. It's a difficult balance. In order to make decisions, you've got to weigh the pros and cons. You do it with the best interests of the province at heart. You do it with the best information that's available to you at the time. So when I sit down and I give my evidence at an inquiry, and when I'm about to espouse the benefits of Muskrat Falls, I get cut off by the commissioner, who basically says, I don't want to hear that. Well, part of my decision, part of the reason we embarked on Muskrat Falls in the beginning, because we looked at the pros and the cons. We had exhausted every possible avenue with Quebec to do Gull Island and to develop the mid-Churchill, is what I call it. So then we reverted back to reverted over to a Muskrat Falls scenario, and then looked at ways to make that work because we didn't have any alternative. We had the dirty emissions producing Holyrood and Seal Cove. We got the best advice at the time that was available. Now, that was in 2010. That was gate two of the process. Subsequently, through the next 2 years, there was even more. The federal government were on board. The banks were on board. International experts were on board. Experts of Manitoba were on board. So all the best information was put together to make the best possible decision by the people who were involved. So that was, that was me at one point. And then beyond that, that were other people who moved into my position. If you think for 1 minute that it was my intention to saddle our province with burdensome debt, that is my point on critics. Critics just talk about the numbers, but they don't look at the value. As a leader, and I hope you get elected someday, you will find that you need to have a big picture vision.
That's former Premier Danny Williams speaking today at an economic conference hosted by MUN's Department of Economics here in St. John's. And, your thoughts on that, you're welcome to share them with us. Thanks for listening.